This is the West Enterprise Center Start and Grow Your Business podcast. Hi, I'm David Wolf. Joining us on this segment is a very talented entrepreneur who understands the power of timing in business. Krisha Boynes is the president of Vapor. The company is pushing the limits of green chemistry by pioneering a full line of healthy, non-toxic cosmetics. The history of the development of their unique products actually started about 30 years ago in a lab in Taos, New Mexico. And then after some years in the business, a well-known cosmetic professional named Eric Sekas discovered their unique formulations and fell in love with them and the line. Krisha knew it was then time to launch a new brand. Joining us on the line right now from Taos, New Mexico, to share the amazing business story is Krisha Boynes. She's the president of Vapor. Krisha, welcome to the program.
Hi, David. Thanks for having me.
Take us back to the early days. You're thinking about sustainable right out of Carnegie Mellon University. How did you develop such an affinity for plants and sustainable design?
I don't know how I started in with plants. I think my mom was a gardener, and she allowed me to have a small plot of plants at home, and I grew strawberries.
Right.
And that was the beginning of my love for plants. I had sort of a natural green thumb. And then when I was in school, I guess that piece of the puzzle was learning about sustainability and how it could be incorporated into architecture and all different kinds of business models. And that got me thinking, what can I do to, you know, be part of the solution and not part of the problem?
One of the things I noticed about your career is that you worked for Disney Studios as a set designer. How did that creative and sort of imagineering environment at Disney inform the work you ultimately set out to do? How did this fit in?
You know, it was really great right out of college getting that job. Of course, I was the lowest man on the totem pole, so I don't know if they would call me a set designer. I was technically a PA, but we were working on a period film, and I was doing a lot of shopping for period lamps and wallpaper and things like that, and then actually constructing period packaging. And just being in an office and being in the studio with all of these creative people, I was so inspired and excited to figure out a career path for myself where I could continue to be creative. And Disney was a great place to start.
And I know that even earlier you created the concept for Plenish, and we're going to circle back to that in a moment. I also noticed that you had a stint in the real estate business down in Boca Raton, if I have that right. This was a pure business experience, a sales experience, wasn't it?
Absolutely. It was completely mainstream business, and, you know, it doesn't get any more mainstream than it does down in Boca Raton, Florida. But that was a really good place for me to learn a little bit about sales and just about how deals are constructed and the art of negotiating and that kind of thing. So that was some just really basic mainstream kind of stuff that has served me well.
Okay, very cool. Now, the concept for Plenish actually started while you were still in school. Tell us about the concept.
I was taking a class, and we were supposed to design a mail order catalog, know who our customer was, and design unique products for our customer, and then actually create the catalog. And so me and my friend Peter Albert came up with the name Plenish, and we designed a catalog that would have some products for all of your senses. And so we had products for vision and products for sound, and we also had sort of the last category, more ethereal, for your spirit. And we completely used, we pulled from folklore and history and just creativity out of our own brains, and we came up with really fun things. I'm going to give you an example.
Sure.
there is this product everyone needs. It's called the Pure Tone Equalizer. And what it is it's small pieces of volcanic rock from Hawaii. And when you hold these rocks up to your ear, it stops the vibration of the inner ear and gives you absolute peace and quiet. Our inner ear naturally vibrates all the time, and this particular rock stopped that inner vibration so you could actually be quiet. And so the catalog was full of fun products like that. Everybody wanted to buy them, but of course they were completely fictitious.
Right. It was a theoretical discussion, wasn't it?
Absolutely. But what was interesting also about that was just really thinking deeply about who our customer was and what our customer would want. And that has served me greatly because with Vapor now, we've done a lot of thinking about who our customer is, what do they really want, what's not out there in the marketplace, and, you know, what can we provide for them that's unique.
We are visiting with Krisha Boynes. She's the president and co-founder of Vapor. That website, www.vapor, that's VAPOUR beauty.com, vaporbeauty.com. Okay, so Taos, New Mexico, you decide it's time to manifest a company called Plenish, obviously an extension of this vision. Tell us about how you created the company Plenish and how it eventually led to the creation of Vapor.
I moved to Taos without knowing anyone, and so that was kind of stepping out on a ledge, and knew that I was going to start my own business and that I needed to move out west to do that. I was born in Washington, D.C., and it's very conservative back east. And somehow I knew that with all my friends graduating from, you know, Ivy League schools and going on to work on Wall Street or whatever, that making candles in my basement wasn't really going to fly unless I was separated by distance. So here I came out to Taos, and I did just that. I bought a Martha Stewart Living magazine and got really inspired and started making candles and putting botanicals that I was growing myself and collecting out in the wild into the candles.
Wow.
And essential oils, and they were very beautiful. And now there's a million Chinese knockoffs of that idea. But I think I did it first. And then I started
absolutely,
you know, expanding into soap and different things that were using natural ingredients, started learning about natural formulation. I then met my now husband, Greg Martin, who had started the business Aunt Bee Skincare, and started learning about making other types of cosmetic products. They specialized in lip balm. And they had a very interesting thing, which was they had a private label deal with an Estee Lauder company, and they were making products for Estee Lauder, so they had extremely high quality control standards, and I got a real education about what it meant to make really high quality products. Estee Lauder quality standards, no one's are higher than that. So did that. And the reason that we were going to do private label was that we didn't have the money that it would take to launch a brand. We understood that launching a brand was extremely expensive, and we could have a lot of fun making and designing and manufacturing products for these other brands without actually having the expense of marketing our own brand. So we did that for many years.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense.
And honed our skills, and we, you know, somewhere along the line, we left Aunt Bee's, and Plenish was our private label manufacturing company, and had a lot of success making things for different fashion designers and celebrities and brands that you would find in Whole Foods or Sephora or different department stores. So we really had a lot of experience making stuff for people.
Yeah. At this point, what's the scale of Plenish? What does it look like in terms of the physical plant, the employees?
At that point, over the years, Plenish was in, you know, maybe about 3,000 square feet and had under 10 people working.
Yeah, still really a micro manufacturer. Aside from the fact that you were doing some pretty high-profile brand private label work.
Yeah, very small scale. And a lot of what kept us very small was the fact that we were making products for the lips, which are tiny. You know, you can fit 1,500 lip balms in a very small shipping box, as opposed to, you know, two dozen shampoos. So,
sure.
So that helped us sort of make a lot of products in a small footprint.
Mm.
And then we decided that, you know, this private label thing was really good, and we developed a lot of products, and it was time to do our own brand. And that is when we were hooked up by chance with Eric Fakus. Eric had gotten a sample of one of our products from another client, actually, and tried it on the back of his hand, fell in love with the texture, loved the performance, thought it was something really unique, and said, you know, where did you get this? And she said, well, I'm not telling you. That's my secret. And she did slip the word New Mexico, and so Eric jumped on that, Googled us, found us, and contacted us, said, I love this product. I had the opportunity to sample it, love it. Tell me more. And we said, well, guess what? It's 70% organic. It's mineral pigment suspended in a base of certified organic botanicals.
Wow.
And his mouth dropped to the floor, and he was even more in love. He's like, oh, my God, I had no idea that an organic product could have this kind of performance.
Oh, wow. So he really wasn't looking for something organic per se, but he found out afterwards.
Well, his dream was that he could find something that was going to be pure and natural and organic and have high function, but had never run across anything that met all of those criteria.
Wow.
So it was, we were just all really excited that we had found each other at that point and started creating paper.
There are a lot of elements to creating a cosmetic product. As you were describing, there's texture, there's aroma, there's color, there's how is it suspended, there's a chemical engineering piece to this. It's quite involved, isn't it, as a design process?
It's a very involved design process, and when you actually take chemicals out of the process, which is what we do because we don't use any chemicals,
right.
It becomes a lot more complex. The reason that there are so many companies out there that use chemicals is because they're cheap and they're easy to formulate with.
Sure, makes sense.
And when you take things, take ingredients out that are designed to hold pigment in suspension or extend the amount of time that fragrance is going to stay fragrant.
Yeah.
You run into a lot of challenges, and I think that's why a lot of traditional companies have backed away from, you know, spending the R&D time and money to develop safe and beautiful products that actually work.
Krisha, you and your partner, you know, kind of reached a point where you said, hey, we want to do our own brand. But for many years, you didn't, you decidedly stayed away from doing your own brand, and you've explained why. What shifted for you when you decided to crawl into your own brand and really go that route?
You know, I felt like we had grown as much as we could with what we were doing. We were showing really innovative, great formulas to some of our clients and new potential clients, and some of the people were not jumping on the products that we thought were the most exciting. And, you know, we'd seen a lot of products, we'd tried everything, we'd made a bunch of stuff for a lot of people, and we knew that we had some real winners. And it was like, you know, we've been working on some of these things and refining them for years and years. Let's bring them to market. We know that people are going to love them. We love them. And we know who our customers are. We know that they're going to really like these products. So it was really that. And then we knew that we didn't know anything about marketing and that we didn't have that kind of background. So it was really hooking up with Eric that and his industry background and his expertise and his respect in the industry that we knew that we would, you know, have a shot to do something really special.
So there's a shift here. Are you still doing private label work while you're developing your own brand, Vapor Beauty?
Absolutely. We have all of our private label customers, and when they hear this, they're probably not going to be
I was going to say.
Very happy about
right.
it.
Well, they're parallel universes, aren't they?
Yeah. But, you know, we're not being, I mean, on our website, for example, we talk about the fact that the products are made in Taos, New Mexico, and we've been a private label manufacturer for years and years. There's very few of them in Taos, so if they haven't figured it out already, they're going to figure it out now.
Well, sure, with the World Wide Web and interviews like these, oh, we're making
yeah,
lots
and our,
of...
and our own website. I mean, our own
sure,
website,
sure.
We're very transparent about who we are. And yes, we're absolutely making beautiful products. And one of the things that we do really well is because we design and manufacture our own products for our private label customers and ourselves,
yeah.
I have a, you know, a belief that there is room for a lot of beautiful products on the shelf, and we design into each product uniqueness. So if we're designing for one of our other customers, we're going to have a unique ingredient profile, texture, scent, and color palette that's going to work for their brand. And same thing for the next guy. Totally unique, different color palette, scent, texture, formula, packaging, et cetera, et cetera. So each brand that we design for has a very unique character, and it's not all the same stuff.
I love this. Krisha Boynes is joining us. She's the president of Vapor. That website, www.vaporbeauty.com. And that's Vapor with a V-A-P-O-U-R beauty.com, vaporbeauty.com. I wanted to ask you about the distribution, the transaction, the sales model. What does that look like right now, and where do you see that headed?
Well, we launched Vapor in August of 2009, and of course we all know what was going on out in the world in 2009.
It was a relatively new initiative for you.
Yes, very, very new for us, and not a great year economically to be launching a new brand. So what we did was we decided that we were going to be sort of launch very specifically, and what we did was we are on ShopNBC in the United States. We have just launched on the one and only shopping channel in Canada, which is called The Shopping Channel, and we're actively pursuing QVC in the UK and Australia and Germany.
Very cool.
So by selling on television, we do a show. We go, we have a visit, we get to be in millions of people's homes and share the brand with many, many people in one fell swoop. Rather than doing a traditional retail model, we've decided not to do traditional retail right now. Retail is struggling in the United States, and it's not a good time for us to spend our dollars in that arena.
Right, so you're leveraging from what I'll call sort of quasi-traditional media. There's a two-way conversation with a lot of these QVC-type environments, isn't there?
What do you mean a two-way?
Where people can call in or comment. Is that an element to this?
Yes, we love when we have callers call in, and yes, there's definitely a dialogue back and forth. And then our website is our other big portal to the world, and we get tons of comments, and we're very active with our customer service in being very hands-on with our customers and asking them, you know, to give us feedback and really paying attention to what they have to say. And it's just, the digital world is fantastic. I think it's a whole new way to do business, and it's been very good for us.
Well, I love your story. Love the brand. We'll check it out. Chrystia Boynes has been joining us. She's the co-founder and president of the company Vapor. Extraordinary story in green cosmetics. These are non-toxic cosmetics and very healthy as well. The website is vaporbeauty.com, V-A-P-O-U-R, and the word beauty.com. Chrystia, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, David. It's been a pleasure.
Small Biz America.
The brain.
He believes that decorating is a form of empowerment therapy and that his mantra, you can do it, is a way of life. Christopher Lowell, who's been dubbed the Doctor of Design by U.S. News & World Report, is one of America's most recognized and trusted authorities in the home improvement category. His seven-layer system has been fully embraced by the Oprah team, among others, while the success of his ever-growing multimedia company proves that he's made a loyal connection to how America wants to live now and in the future. Today, Christopher is the host of Work That Room with Christopher Lowell on the Fine Living Network, a part of the Scripps Howard family of networks, which also, by the way, includes HDTV. Joining us on the line from Santa Fe, New Mexico, is award-winning host and best-selling author, the Doctor of Design, Christopher Lowell. Christopher, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. That was a lovely introduction.
Oh, you're very,
I'm blushing.
You're very welcome. Take us back to 1970, a younger Christopher Lowell. You're the pure artist. You're working in the theater. How did working in the theater inform the work you ultimately would find yourself doing in a more corporate environment or even in people's homes and workspaces?
Well, working in the theater, I was a set designer and a costume designer and a lighting designer, and for many years I was one of the few who held all three of those titles and was able to go across all three of those unions. When you design for the theater, under the tight constraints, having to do interpret plays in worlds that don't even exist, and then break them down and travel them all across the country, it is far more rigorous a discipline than any interior designer will ever go through. But what really, I got to a cross point in my life where I realized that even though I knew that I knew the show part, it was the business part that I needed to really learn. So I opened up an advertising agency, started in Boston and then moved to New York, and we basically went out after the accounts that nobody else wanted. And the very first one at that time was a female product. So they came to us and they said, we can't figure out how to sell this thing. It's a feminine hygiene product, and it's going to be played at noon during soap operas while people are eating.
Yeah.
Have at it.
Wonderful challenge.
We were the ones that created the word freshness, and we had lots of chiffon and women and daughters talking to each other, and in a weird way, it kind of put us on the map. I loved the advertising business because I could tell short stories very quickly, and my little sort of tragically hip company was really the first to sell the sizzle and not the steak. We were the first to show the guy coming home from war and put the coffee cup way up at the front of the screen. And I loved that because it was sort of theater, it was sort of storytelling. And then I began to be hired by big Fortune 500 companies, most of them being in the cosmetic business. And they were having a very difficult time trying to translate this ethereal thing called color with business and retail in makeup and that kind of a thing.
Yeah.
So I did several re-imagings for several of the big makeup lines. That became successful, and suddenly I was asked to introduce Formici hair color to the United States. And then people like Paul Mitchell came along and Trevor Sorby, and it kind of became a moniker, and I found that within business, I was speaking to women, and I had reached a touch point where I understood so much of how women bought, how they shopped, et cetera, et cetera. But I was slowly getting corporate burnout. I would go from city to city and literally come in-house, be their creative director, in those days starting video departments, doing all their advertising commercials, doing their media buys, billboards, etc. And I finally got to the point where I said, you know, I've got to get back to my roots. I'd always believed that my great passion in the arts had always been trying to figure out the difference between talent and creativity. And I'd started that journey, and I really wasn't, I really felt that I hadn't fully embraced that. And as I began to look at the interior design world, I was trying to find a metaphor that I could now take all the skills that I had and develop a television series that would be new at that time. So obviously, Martha Stewart at that point was had not gone commercial yet. She was still on PBS. And I kind of took a look at what she was doing, and she was really appealing to a more affluent, stay-at-home mom who, and her show was very sort of aspirational as she trotted you around Turkey Hill. And yet, I didn't have women like that in my family, and I began to realize that most of the women I knew worked for a living. In the 90s, that was a difficult proposition for women. I was also watching the Tool Times segment of Home Improvement, and I was watching Tim Allen sort of play this self-effacing kind of guy whose gadgets would blow up, and I kept flipping sort of back and forth in my mind between the rigid Martha Stewart, who was standing beside a beehive in one segment saying, and so for the price of $10,000, you too can enjoy the rewards of harvesting your own honey.
Yes.
So I'm saying to myself, gosh, there's just no real information. I had a lot of design background at that point. I understood business. I understood the commerce. I understood how to convey ethereal ideas like color and scale and that kind of a thing. So my team came to me and they knew that I was about ready to bail because I'd really had enough of doing it for other people, and really pushed me to really look at the home improvement category. So I did. And I suddenly was driving through town in Chagrin Falls, Ohio. I was there for a company called Matrix Essentials. They had wanted me to create the first Greenpeace-driven shampoo line because they knew Aveda was about to do that. So I came up with a concept called Biolage Shampoo, science in sync with nature. And we got the Jacques Cousteau Society involved and so on and so forth. Well, it got me to Chagrin Falls, Ohio to work with that team for the next couple of years. And I happened to be driving through town. I drove my car over this waterfall road, and I looked up and I saw this 18th century building and a big for rent sign, and I just knew in my gut, you know what? Experiment. Try. So I opened up the first very first decorative home art center, and my goal was to take a lot of the information that I had learned over the years about how to enroll a community, and we charried out the space, and we opened our doors, and for the next 3 years, we graduated 3,000 men and women, and we shot 2,200 hours of documentary footage using the home as the metaphor to get people engaged and raise self-esteem.
Oh, wow.
What was really phenomenal to me and why I really knew I had to move forward at that point, even though it had been probably more research and design than any how-to show on the planet, I began to cycle through all of the footage. Here, and what I'd realized is that here I had amassed literally 3 years of thousands of people transforming right in front of my eyes. I could only edit about an hour of it at a time because I just would get teary-eyed. And what I realized is that this was the most powerful thing. I watched these working, stressed-out women come up. You know, they were caught in the middle. The feminists were beating them up because they couldn't stay and puncture the glass ceiling at the time.
Yeah.
Their biological clocks were ticking. They knew that if they were that they were going to have to wait to join the forces again. Meantime, they were going to come home and have a child and then go back to work. And, of course, the stay-at-home mom said, "You're a heathen." So they were getting no support anywhere. And I looked at that while Martha was beginning to gain traction, and I said, that is our future. And that woman is going to marry a very different man than her mom married.
Ooh.
So between that and then taking a look at this footage where I watched these women come in absolutely screwy-eyed, and I watched them over the course of 3 years with us, not only did they, were their shoulders back and their spirit light, but they were starting their own cottage industries based on what we were teaching them. And I said, okay, if I can get this to television, that's what I want to do. So we completed doing a documentary on creativity, using all of that footage and telling that story. We took it to the NAPTI convention in 95. The Discovery Channel looked at it, didn't quite know what it was, but knew that it was something, and they didn't want anybody else to get it. So they optioned us, and we said, no options. If you're going to do it, you got to take it, and we got to be on the air. Well, this was the middle of the year, and by the end of that year, we were finishing production, and in January of 96, we debuted.
At the centerpiece of so much of your work, Christopher Lowell, is this concept of courage and creativity.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, do I have it right? Is that the centerpiece in terms of what you deliver to these women through the three-year program and so forth?
The thing I was worried about so much was that the American audience would not understand what I was doing. One of the things that was very key to me, which was a very big fight and struggle. You got to remember, at that time, on a commercial network, nobody had ever done home improvement. They didn't think it was viable. They didn't think that it made good TV programming. All of the programs up to that point were either on PBS, This Old House, and Martha, but nothing had gone national, and HGTV didn't exist at that time.
Yeah.
So I had to go back to Los Angeles, where I'd lived for many years before I went to Chagrin, and I had to go back and I had to sell this concept and sell this idea. And one of the components that I used to sell it was personality and humor. I said, you know what, we're going to dress up in cockamamie things. We're going to do what's called a comedy cold open. And we kind of laid it out to the folks at Discovery, even though they were incredibly skeptical about it. The goal was to get them laughing right at the top of the show, give them a really safe place to come, let them understand that we could be slightly naughty, but never mean-spirited. And I think for the first year that we were on the air, most people watched the show because it was fun, and they felt better about themselves, and that was the point. And then we found, through the thousands of letters that poured in, I mean, literally within 3 months, we were the highest-rated show in the history of the Discovery Channel, because people could look into my eyes, they knew that I'd been poor at some time in my life, they knew that I came from a working family. You know, the camera doesn't lie, you know?
Yeah, they can feel it. This is an emotional
connection.
I wanted to shift gears just a bit. So much to cover with you. We can go one of six, seven, eight directions. What is the seven-layer system, and how does that work?
On top of having comedy and ending my show with a motivating message to my audience that had nothing to do with interior design but really had to do with their own spirit, and saying to them that the mental interior always matches the physical interior, and if you change one, the other will change. Very powerful message.
Yeah.
The other thing that was important to me is that before I came to television, and really the only reason why I opened up the shop in the first place, is I wanted to make sure, like any good business, that I had not only the right number of points of distinction, but I wanted, before we got to television, to have worked out an educationally based system that defied creed, that defied socioeconomics, etc. So for the all of those years, we were developing the seven layers of design. And the seven layers of design is simply this. We started out, by the way, with 137. and over the course of it, it was the American public. It was these women who told us, look, don't talk to me about electricity. I'll hire an electrician. Here's where it breaks down for me. I walk into a paint store. I see 10 billion paint swatches, and I freak out in a high testosterone environment.
Yeah.
Well, all of that was not only great fodder for comedy, but it was telling us what working American women at that time were, you know, where they were falling down. So the seven layers ended up being divided into seven sequential roadmap layers. They were divided at the point when women freak out. And we found out later, of course, that that everybody freaks out. It defied gender. And the idea is you start from the scariest thing in the world called color. And at that time, everybody was living with white walls. And those who weren't living with white walls had done jewel tones. Remember jewel tones?
Yes, yes.
Yes, and so all their dining rooms all painted red looked like Red Cross stations. You know what I'm saying?
Exactly.
So we start there, and then we work our way down into the various layers of flooring. I mean, simple things like don't put a lot of money into the floor, because by the time you put six more layers into it, how much of that floor are you really going to see? You know? And so we began to develop not only a strategy that really communicated, that we knew would communicate well on TV, but we also had most of the book written before we even went to television, because it was absolutely important to me that we start off show number one with the seven layers of design and the comedy and the motivation and a socioeconomic base that really reflected what at that time nobody in America was talking about.
When you approached the project of designing furniture, and I know you're involved with having recently completed the release of a whole new product line, talk about what that process was like. How did you approach the designing of these three distinctive lines, and what did you hope to communicate with those designs?
One of the things that we were very blessed with from a very early age is we had touched such a core with the American audience, and we were touching a core with him as well as her, because we would say on the air, ladies, curb your words. You know, the guy's just getting up to speed here. I would say to the American public, guys have a better sense of classic than you women do, because your women are storytellers. And so you'll pick a fabric that has, you know, hydrangeas in a watering can, and that gets all over the house, and the poor guy feels like he doesn't live there. Well,
right.
This struck a chord too, and so suddenly at that time we began to realize that our show was the most videotaped show in America, because the women were taping it and then showing it to their husbands. So we created this bond. So when we went to start developing product, we would do room redos, and there were things that we couldn't find in the marketplace, so we would make them ourselves, and our audience would say, where'd you get that? How can I get that? And then we began to really begin to open up social networking at a time when Twitter didn't even exist, and so we used our site to ask the American public, what do you need, what's not working, what on the show did you connect with, and what didn't. It became apparent to the American public that they had a hand in designing what we put on the market, and today, that relationship still exists, because the one thing I did not want to do is indulge me and my creative team in stuff that we thought was really cool, but American public didn't need, especially in lower economic bases.
I should mention we're visiting with Christopher Lowell, the doctor of design, www.christopherlowell.com. Also, of course, officedepot.com/ChristopherLowell.com for more information on those new designs that are a part now of the universe of, certainly Christopher Lowell's expressions, but also Office Depot as well. You're as much tapped into behavior and connection and emotion and the colors of emotion as you are into design itself. But if there was an influencer for you in terms of your approach to what I'll call visual or three-dimensional design, who or what was it?
It was really, I started out with a psychology background. I thought for a long time that was the field that I was going to go into.
Yeah.
I loved the idea of communicating.
Yeah.
I was luckily, a very talented artist who was burdened with too much talent. And I could see very quickly in the American culture that Americans were confusing talent with creativity.
Yes.
You know, and
yes.
And now with the media, it's just become out of control. And what people began to think was, if I'm not talented and I am not visibly talented in a performing or artistic sort of way,
right,
and I'm not going to give it more than 15 minutes to be rich and famous, I got to go live a depressed life.
Right.
The reality of it was, is what we were teaching on television every day is that personal creativity is part of our brain. It's a mechanism that is an antidote to stress that we all have to get in touch with. So this sort of anthropological approach was really the underpins that kept us on course, not only in our relationship with the human public and viewer, but it also really drove the culture of our own business. So it was really, you know, when I go to design a home, I stop for a second and I say to myself, okay, what's new in the home now? I've watched just what's happened in open concepts, and I kept predicting on the air that these walls were going to become tumbling down, and you... All of you who had were accommodating these rooms that you never went into unless company was there,
right,
were not fully living. So I began working with the American Builders Association and places like that. And we began to start tumbling these walls down, and I began to do it on the show. And as I would preach about these, what at that time were alarming statistics, the American public saw all of it came true. I was the first to introduce bamboo on the air, and everybody thought their home was going to look like Gilligan's Island.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
But here
love
we
bamboo.
Are. We were the first to talk about sustainability. We were, you know, and really talking about how to use every square inch of your home for you, not your company.
And at the end of the day, you're helping people learn, well, first of all, to be courageous and certainly to live a creative life, fully
yeah.
creative life, well, regardless of how the media tends to label you as this sort of polarity you've described between talent and creativity.
That's exactly right. I had an opportunity when I was still doing theater in Boston, going back and forth from Boston to New York, fascinated by this idea of what creativity really was and could it be translated or unburied in the masses. So Boston University allowed me to take a... I think it was called Boston College at the time. They allowed me to take a classroom, and I mimeographed a sheet, and I'll tell you how long ago that was.
I remember that word.
Yeah, right. Mimeograph. Remember that? Ching,
sure.
Ching, ching. Okay.
The round
and
thing.
It just
said,
creativity, what is it? Do you have it? If you do, can you keep it? That
right.
was on the poster.
Right.
And I was expecting to do basically a two-week course really to teach me about where people opinions were at, so I really didn't have a curriculum. Well, we ended up teaching that course for 3 years. People would come in really confused about it, having all sorts of weird ideas about whether they were talented or not, what creativity was, and as we began to literally unburden them with all of the excuses that they weren't creative, every single one of them, without a doubt, always had that moment where they had that breakdown, when they realized that creativity was inherent to them and that creativity spanned everything that the human factor is able to do. Well, people would dash out of that class every Thursday night, you know, going, Jesus, you know, and suddenly the professors were saying, what the hell are you teaching in there? They wanted me to actually take that into an accredited course, and they had not really supported me outside of giving me that classroom for about 2 years. So I went in front of the board, and they asked me to develop a thesis, and they gave me a student to help develop the thesis, and I said, no, I don't need that. And I said, I don't need a year to develop the thesis. I'll do it tomorrow. So they all got together, and I walked in, and I bought a really nice binder, and it reminded me of that scene in Flashdance where the girl does her audition.
Yes, yes.
Okay?
Yes.
These dour gray people at the end of the room. And I took the book, stuck it down in front of them, they opened it, and there was one single page. And it said, where there is fear, there is no creativity. Meaning, that it's fear that inhibits us from finding ourselves. And then I began to connect the dots later by saying, well, wait a second here. I need a task for these people to do, because I've proven to them that they are creative, but I didn't give them a task to do. So the TV show was really that task. And I said, if you can't fail an experiment under your own home in something, the most personal thing that you'll ever build for yourself in your life, then where are you going to? And then that's what gave me the impetus to open the shop and move forward and try to get this thing on national television.
So national TV. There's also a radio component to this. Do I have that right?
Yes, we have suspended that for a little while because we're actually getting ready to do a brand new web series that we can talk about as well.
Oh, wonderful. Well, I've now learned that it's impossible to compress this kind of energy into a 15-minute segment with Christopher Lowell. I hope we can do it again. I love the message. I love the work you're doing. I've been a creative person all my life as well. Many of our listeners are small business. They're innovators. They're looking to live creatively in their businesses and their life. This whole idea of metaphor and fear versus creativity, love it. And,
well, you know, one of the things that we're working on very hard right now is showing people how to task, how to use the internet, how to be mobile now, because that's going to change our lives next. So I really encourage everybody to go to Office Depot. I've done 18 videos there so people can watch them in their jammies and get inspired about how they want to work tomorrow.
Oh, I love it. Christopher, thanks so much. A delight to have you. And
thank
we'll
you.
Do it again for sure.
Small Biz America.
The brain.
Online at smallbizamerica.com.
Small Biz.
Small Biz America.
Thanks for listening to the West Enterprise Center Start and Grow Your Business podcast. For more information, visit us at west.org.